Well, it is fantastic here in London at the Quaker Centre to meet Simon Smith. Now, Simon, now we've known each other for years and years, although haven't seen each other in person for, must be about 20.
I think it is 20, yeah. I think it's, since I was external examiner at Carmarthen and you were there.
So I was there for 3 years, and I think you were based at Leeds at the time.
Yeah.
And we were just talking before we started recording that we obviously have a Lampeter connection as well. I don't think we knew each other there, because we overlapped maybe for only about 1 year.
That's right.
But you were an undergraduate and a master's student, is that right?
I was, yeah. I did an undergraduate degree in religious studies from 1988 to 91, and then I stayed on and did the Interfaith Studies MA for the following year, before I then went off to do my PhD at Leeds.
And I always feel, and I suppose we're all a little bit biased about our own undergraduate days, maybe nostalgic, I'm sure that will come up, but the number of people who said to me, both staff and students, that that was, you know, the golden age, certainly at Lampeter. Maybe it was a time of some considerable growth, you know, for a small place, that the student numbers were rocketing in that period. And maybe that wasn't the trajectory that, that lasted. But it kind of felt at the time that it was a very sort of optimum place to be, to study theology. In my case, I did a degree in theology. But did you have that sense as well?
Well, I had that sense from the moment I applied, actually, because I was working in a bank straight after school for 6 years. For reasons we might come on to, I got an interest in Indian religions. And I was looking around for a place to study religion a bit further. From a visit to India, actually, I got interested. I looked around a lot of universities, and there was only Lampeter were teaching all the major religions at the time, which is, you know, quite incredible for such a small place. And I think religious studies had come over from Aberystwyth. You know, there's an existing, very well-established theology department there, and a growing and new and quite vibrant religious studies department that brought two academics came over from Aberystwyth, I think, but then there was a lot of new recruitment during that time. So it was very fresh, and it was felt like a very vibrant place.
Yeah, and that was my sense as well, because, you know, I came from the big city, although I suppose I lived more in the suburbs, and at the age of 18, a city life would, you know, going to Manchester or Leeds or even Canterbury, perhaps, at that point probably wasn't the obvious sort of route for me to follow. Perhaps ironic in terms of a lot of the media interests I have, because, you know, I went sort of westwards, whereas, yeah, you know, kind of maybe that wasn't the route that a lot of my contemporaries took. But it was right. But it's sort of going into this incredible place, in the, like an oasis almost, that, you know, in West Wales, in a very sort of rural market town, that you suddenly had, as you say, you could study, certainly in the time that I was there, Confucianism. You could study Arabic. You could study, almost, you know, I'm sure Japanese came in at one point, but you could study, as you say, all the main traditions and learn Sanskrit. You know, it just kind of felt that it may have been a lot smaller than some of the larger universities, but it certainly didn't, you know, fall short in terms of the quality of its teaching delivery. So that felt quite special.
Absolutely, I think, some of the things that they introduced while I was there, you know, they introduced the new religious movements course, religion and the media course. Which you will be, no doubt, you no doubt took.
I didn't, and that's another one. Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think there were things in my second year options that were not even there when I first. You know, my main motivation was to study the major religions, but then there was things that you know, Deirdre Green came and did mysticism, and Chris Arthur came and did religion and media, and so all of a sudden you had this incredible variety of different subjects within religious studies, which really kind of, you felt as if you were somewhere, particularly when, you know, if you went to and talked to students from other universities, you know, that they were quite amazed by the breadth of things that you could do within Lampeter.
And you just made me think that I reckon I must have been playing a long game without realising it, because I remember going to see Chris Arthur, would have been the summer of my first year, just after my first year, so that would have been around 92. And I remember going to see him about the religion and media course, knowing that media was an interest of mine. But for some reason, it just, at that point, I think, maybe because I was doing theology, and I remember the choices between that module and Christianity to 84.61 with Reverend Selwyn. And it's interesting because a few years later, Chris was my PhD supervisor. But it's almost as though I put in place all the foundations of the degree that I'd set out to do, and then I was able to diversify. And I remember actually a lot of that stuff on Christology I used in my PhD. So that wasn't Chris's area at all, but it was having done that elsewhere. So in a funny way, you know, when people say, I'm sure you've had this as well, they say, Lambeth is a long way away. You know, how did you last? As many, you were there 4 years, I was there 10. But I reckon that you can play a long game at a place. If you kind of know what you're looking for and you pace yourself appropriately, you know, it was a jewel.
Well, I mean, I would have never expected, you know, when I was quite green behind the ears in terms of what academia was. I was never a very academic person at school. I got terrible A-levels, and, you know, which is one of the reasons I went into work. But I got there and immediately did well. And, you know, I would have never expected to have been doing, for instance, Chris allowed me to do an essay on the religious aspects of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in which I put a large Don't Panic on the inside of the cover. Even as an undergraduate, being given that sort of freedom was really, really good. You know, going up completely off piece.
And I bet you've still got that.
Yeah.
I bet you read it.
I read all four books in the space of 2 days, and my head was so full. I'm normally a get up early and do something person, but my head was so full of everything. I just had to get it all down overnight. And get it in, because it was a really interesting experience just loading those four books up of the trilogy all together, looking at it in the whole, and looking at Adams's views of religion, and in a lot of ways ridiculing it, but also in many ways actually. Bringing things out of it as well.
And that's what I find so amazing about, because I teach on a religious studies degree programme, and, you know, the students will often find that they're able to do things during the degree that perhaps the equivalent programme at school didn't, for obvious reasons, allow them to do. But I always find it funny how people often in other disciplines sometimes perceive what we do. And there's this assumption, and I have it with some colleagues, wonderful people, but often the assumption that we just talk about God, and somehow that if you don't believe in God, then somehow you wouldn't belong in a religious studies department, and therefore if they don't believe in God, then somehow this is a strange, you know, in a secular university, why would you teach that? And I find it's so, maybe we all need binaries sometimes, but if you're doing that programme, you're collapsing binaries left, right and centre, if that's, well, maybe that's not actually possible, but yes, yeah, although that's the third way maybe, but it's funny how you can have those sort of opportunities. And you want to celebrate that. Almost proselytize, he uses that word carefully, about it. But in a way, you that, I don't know if you ever found then, that when you were explaining what you're doing to people from outside, they might have looked and thought, how does that fit?
Well, the question is always, are you religious?
Yeah.
And even, you know, going into doing a PhD in Buddhism in the West, you know, the first question I always get asked is, are you a Buddhist? Which the answer is always no, I'm not. I'm atheist.
Yeah.
But I find religion endlessly interesting. And I find the way that religion is, you find it in society and in individuals is endlessly interesting. But in terms of developing my own kind of belief system, it's not something that I feel the necessity to do, but I fully understand why other people do.
Yeah, and it's similar in a way, although in my case I did have an Anglican background, which I kind of dropped in a way, you know, even until going to university I would go to my Anglican church. But I think what I was clearly doing was trying to find answers to questions that I was never going to find there in the same way. I always remember, and I mentioned this, I'm sure, in other interviews, how we had, this was before women priests, and I remember talking to our deacon, who was female, would have been late 80s when I was at school, and we were doing a project on women priests, and I thought, oh, if I ask her about that, she'd be really pleased, you know, but she must have a view on this. And maybe it was because the vicar, the male, obviously, vicar, was next to her, but, you know, the look on her face was clearly, you shouldn't have raised that. It was like clearly a taboo question. And I remember going away so disappointed, thinking, what if I can't talk about women priests with someone who's a female deacon in an age when you couldn't have female priests? You know, that was as close as I could get. And she was a very hands-on figure in the church. So in that sense, it just felt very strong, you know, strange and difficult. And I think years later, I just realised that obviously these issues are not straightforward. Like, this is my view, but I could have another view tomorrow. You know, this is actually an ingrained thing, and obviously would have, and her relationship with others would have been affected by you know, what she was allowed or not allowed to do. But so going to university, and I remember even like doing these essays with Paul Badham and others, and just suddenly finding that I could almost say kind of what I wanted, you know, through a proper academic inquiry, but I wasn't going to be offending somebody simply because they were coming from a different kind of starting point. Yeah. Was that kind of what you felt?
Well, I think I was also very fortunate because in the first year we had in the kind of study of religion module I don't know whether he was around when you were at Iswin Blythe in.
That was before my time.
Yeah, he came over with Cyril Williams from Aberystwyth. And he did this first year course on theory of religion, and you know, I came, you know, as I've already said, I came in green behind the gills from a, you know, sitting on a till in a bank, and you know, week after week we were doing Otto, Wittgenstein, Eliade, you know, Ninian Smart, you know, and just getting this incredible grounding in theories of religion that, you know, were absolutely mind-blowing and delivered in a way, you know, that had, you know, been honed over over decades, but not in a way where he'd become bored of what he was teaching. He was still alive, and I remember I did my first essay for him, and I remember I got a mark which I considered to be surprisingly good, and went to chat about it, and you know, he was just so incredibly open about you know, what the possibilities were, and you know, as somebody who hadn't written an essay for 6 or 7 years, that was quite a start for me. I always remember that.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I know lots of colleagues who understandably might be jaded sometimes with the way universities move, certainly arts and humanities, and many people have left the profession or certainly, you know, moved to different sort of positions elsewhere. But when I'm teaching, because I'm teaching in some cases the same modules, I mean, I do update them, but a lot of the stuff isn't, as my students often say, you know, it's funny that all the films I'm referring to like came out in the 90s. It's like, that's funny. You know, I wonder why that is, Chris. You know, like films that made like 20 years before they were born, almost, well, not quite 20, but soon will be, unless I update my module. But what I find when I'm teaching is that I've never lost that curiosity, and almost being taught by the students in that sense, that they will say things that make me rethink something, or, you know, that I never know quite what's going to happen at the end of the session compared to what we might go in with. And I think that important recognition, the reason maybe why we entered a profession in the first place, was because we were driven by those sort of questions. And if we lose that, then actually we all evolve, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if we're still within a particular setting where there are students who want to be taught, and we perhaps have fallen out of almost, we are now disengaged from the very reason that we were once propelled to go down that path, then something is wrong. So maybe, again, why we refer to that period of, you know, late 80s, 90s is a golden age, because that was when a lot of these, for you and for me in that sense, were crystallised.
I think that's right, and I think I don't think I had any lecturers during that period who were anything but forward-looking and you know, genuinely interested in their subject and imparting their subject. But I think certainly from my point of view, I think I really felt the need to get away from that lecturer sort of style, and which is one of the reasons I was very interested in becoming involved in the subject centre that I worked for, because that was very much more of a facilitation rather than a teaching sort of position, and I think I much prefer this, you know, like you were saying about learning from your students. I was much happier sitting in standing in a room full of academics and working with them than, you know, talking to So I think that's kind of one of the reasons that I found that move very interesting and very useful.
Yeah.
Because you know, I find it much more interesting to receive from people. I think I also enjoyed teaching MA courses more because that's very much more of a kind of interactive sort of thing I've found than teaching undergraduate courses.
Well, that's really insightful actually, because I always found that teaching first years was often, and I couldn't quite work out why I always felt quite nervous teaching first years, and I think it was because they hadn't really, or they may have chosen the modules, but they couldn't have known what they were choosing in the sense that, you know, they would maybe they may or may not have been a great choice available to them when they started. But effectively, they may have been sitting there thinking, this is not why I came to university. By the time you get to the second year, the students know exactly. They're choosing a set of modules, then they know what they're going to get, effectively. And they know who, you know, they know the teaching style of the person. So there's a sense of validation that comes with that. And you certainly have it at master's level as well. Although I always used to always feel sometimes, when I started out, when I was teaching the master's students, that maybe in some ways I had to up my game a bit just to show that I was, you know, that some of them had done a previous degree, so I had to offer them something that was, you know, on top of what they'd already got as undergraduates. Otherwise, just like, you know, recycling the same sort of material. So for me, the optimum is probably like second year, maybe certainly third year undergraduate level, when you can start to, you know, you've got, by that point, the students are quite engaged in the subject, but they're still learning, and they know enough to be able to sort of hold their own in conversation. But tell me a bit about that shift then. So it was at Leeds, wasn't it? So it was the subject centre. Tell me what that consisted of.
Well, that consisted of I finished my PhD. I actually had 2 years out in Birmingham. I worked at the Centre for Mission and World Christianity, Selly Oak. I worked on the Harold Turner connection, which kind of came out of my interest in new religious movements, because they, I don't know whether you know Harold Turner, he was kind of a very old school sort of academic, but with a very kind of new way of thinking of collecting things, and he kind of went around the world collecting information on syncretic movements, so, you know, all sorts of Christian local movements in the Philippines, South America, Africa, and he collected this mass resource of information that was basically sitting in a cupboard in the library at the school in Selly Oak. And they were looking for somebody to catalogue it and bring it kind of into a more usable setting, but also were looking for somebody who could bring in some more information on new religious movements from in the West and from Japan and East Asia. So that kind of fitted my interests quite well. So I kind of finished doing my PhD while I was doing that and developing that. And then my supervisor at Leeds went on sabbatical, so I was invited to come and teach on his courses for a year. And while doing that, I kind of became much more interested in kind of other areas of academia in terms of staff development and that sort of thing. And the subject centre came up, which actually the philosopher George MacDonald Ross applied for, but because it was originally called Theology and Philosophy, was the original title, which I kind of said, you can't call it that. Where's the religious studies in that? So it eventually became Philosophical and Religious Studies, but I went on to the bid for that because I was quite interested in that sort of angle. We got funding and we ended up partnering with Lampeter, bizarrely, so that connection stayed alive for quite a long time, and that was all about developing as a staff development within subject areas. So there was 24 subject centres in all, covering all the subjects within the university, of which we were that part. So it was all about developing resources and running events, and which is where the, you know, the facilitation comes in above the kind of teaching. So that was a development that I didn't realise quite was what I was looking for, but when I landed in it, it was definitely the right thing to do, because I still wanted to use what I'd been doing at Lampeter and Leeds and Birmingham to a certain extent, but kind of heading off in a slightly different, unusual direction all the same. And that lasted for about 12 years, that centre. It was very very good, most of a good 12 years.
Yeah. And how did the journey start for you in that sense? Because you obviously, I associate you with Leeds.
Yeah.
But so you're working at a bank before you start. Where was that? Where are you from? Where's home?
Okay, I was born in Chester in the 60s. We'll just say the 60s. and we moved to Hull with my dad's job for 2 years. We lived east of Hull, which, believe me, there's not much east of Hull. and then we moved to near Birmingham when I was 13, and then I kind of had all my those sort of formative years living just outside Birmingham.
Yeah, because your accent, when you mentioned that you were Birmingham for 2 years, I thought, I'm sure that there's another Birmingham connection.
Yeah,
there. So that was home for you.
I can very much drop into a Birmingham accent with a touch of a hat. I went to school in Birmingham, or just outside Birmingham, from 13 onwards, and then 18 left and worked in a small branch in the Black Country for 6 years.
And I'll come on in a minute, because I'd love to know the point. You know, you mentioned you were in your 20s, and there was a point where you thought, right, you know, I need to study studies, because I've interviewed Gary Bunt, who has a similar kind of, you know, a very different sort of background, in his case, with the BBC, and then he ended up having a career in religious studies, Islamic studies, indeed. But one of the things I know that we have in common is a music interest.
That's right.
I suspect we're going to have the same musical interests, but I'd love to know a bit about that as well, because that seems to be the thing that frames you,
definitely is. And you know, I still have a music blog that I write, fragmentedfulaner.com, from an early age, I think I bought my first single when I was 9, which was Blockbuster by The Sweet. It's kind of grown from there. I was doing a bit of revision before this. I was listening to a playlist I've got called My Musical Awakening, which is all the tracks that I have that are kind of, I remember that I actually listened to at early ages, and not the ones that you know, from back in that day that I might like to say I was listened to, but actually I've listened to one of your podcasts. I think it was with Pete Perfides when he was talking about what's cool and what isn't. This is my take all the cool stuff out. There is cool stuff in there probably, but take all the stuff that you would think is cool out. So stuff that I listened to. My mum used to have, I think it was the Light programme, before and then BBC Two, Radio 2, on all the time during the day. So I remember things like Sandy Shaw and Dusty Springfield, and so quite a lot of the Motown stuff. And I remember, you know, that's the sort of stuff that I initially remember, that I still get a kind of tinge inside me when I hear that stuff. And then, you know, I gradually went through glam, and then into punk, and then I think punk was really the point where I really, really got into music, and it all developed from there, really.
Yeah, and I think I had the same. I mean, I haven't let go of a lot of those musical interests. I mean, I was similar to you, actually. I bought, or had bought for me, my first single. I was maybe kind of about 7 going on 8, because I know it was Bucks Fizz, Making Your Mind Up. So, and I know that was around May 1981. My birthday's in June, so I was not quite 8, I think, when that happened. So the age of my children, my youngest, my twin sons now, they're 8. And and that never left me. And I think, and I find that now, because I used to record, even when I was at Lampeter, a lot of stuff off the radio, because they're very carefully thinking of the legal consequences there, but obviously for my own use. And I still listen to all that stuff in the car. I digitised it. So I've got a lot of stuff that I recorded in the 90s, but stuff that in those days, Radio 2 was playing a lot of older stuff, older than the 80s. I mean, you know, 50s, 60s, all the artists that you just mentioned, Sandy Shaw, Dusty Springfield, you can go back further, Bobby Fee, Ebony Brothers and so on. That was a staple in that age. And that was my parents' generation. So I was very aware that I had that twin sort of... I was growing up really in the 80s, but also was very attuned to that 50s, particularly late 50s, early 60s connection. And actually, yeah, the interview with Pete Profitis was great, because obviously his musical tastes are far cooler than mine ever would be. But I was, but he was talking about this. I think I was talking in that interview with him about a particular Cliff Richard song, The Only Way Out, which I just heard, and I just thought, it's good. You know, but he's like, you know, but it doesn't matter, you know, that whole thing about what's cool, because it kind of, if it, my children sometimes will find some of the stuff I listen to bizarre, but at the same time, maybe I would do the same if I was them. The point is, I grew up in that particular era, and I can't shake it. I don't want to shake it. Mm. So listen to a 1981 Pick of the Pops. It's like everyone is like, it's all gold dust. And I think, how come there isn't a single dot, you know, dud piece of music in there? And that's because I think I'm not capable. It's like with student essays, you know, that you can mark a student's essay and give it a good grade. But when it comes to your own work, it's very hard sometimes to know whether you're writing really good stuff or bad stuff, because you're too close to it. Mm. And I think music, I think the analogy is a very, very powerful one.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, the sort of stuff that I remember from that time, you know, it's kind of all linked in with particular, you know, I talked about, you know, I can remember playing on the floor, listening to these songs on Radio 2, which is obviously very evocative. And my father was a tanker driver for BP, and he used to take me out quite a bit. And I remember once we rescued this guy who had broken down, and it turned out he was the guy who filled the jukeboxes full of singles. And so he said, you know, he said, pick one out. And so I picked out Me and You and a Dog Named Boo by Lobo. And so, you know, had I not done that, that song wouldn't be evocative for me even today. And I would just probably roll my eyes when I heard it. But actually, you know, it is, you know, it's on my awakening playlist, because that, you know, I loved going out with him in the tanker, you know. Again, I'm not sure, you know, what the health and safety implications will be to that these days. But, you know, he used to just pick me up, and we used to go into the North Walian countryside and, you know, high up and everything. And so that song reminds me of that because of the incident with the jukebox salesman.
Yeah, and the evocative nature of music. And I want to move on to even radio, if that's a common link in a minute, because I used to find this, and I still find it now, that whether it was the radio was in the background or the foreground when I was doing my academic work, even the two were completely indissoluble. So to this day, I can be thinking of an essay, or maybe reading it if I've still got them, an essay from that period. I know exactly what I was listening to on the radio. I know that it was, you know, Gloria Hunterford on Radio 2 interviewing such and such. Yeah. And it's wonderful to have that. And I suppose for me, when I did the PhD in film, that was taking things up to a different level, because the sort of stuff, I didn't go to the cinema before Lampeter, really, and suddenly those background interests almost became the object of the academic study, was in a, rather than have that almost as the background to the main event, which was the academic study, there was a bit of flipping involved.
Yeah.
So that sort of diversity. But did you have a similar kind, by the sound of it, some of those, that sort of trajectory is a very similar one for you? You know,
well,
yourself.
I remember... you know, I think as I know, my kids do it now, they try and sneak the phones into the rooms late at night. Yes. And you know, my thing was I had a kind of blue blocked Fidelity radio and a little ear. Yes. And I used to either listen to Radio Luxembourg and then a bit later in the evening. And, you know, the number of times I went to sleep listening to a John Peel show, which, you know, when you think back to that, the sort of experimental music that he was playing, you know, on a national, publicly funded broadcaster, night after night after night, is quite remarkable. And, you know, picked up so much in the way of new bands and everything, in a way that you couldn't do then, without the internet, you had your John Peel show, and then Sounds news magazine, which is that stuff that always came off on your hands, which is also evocative, you know. So I used to do my paper round during the week, pick my money up, pick my copy of Sounds up from the place where I was a paper boy, and then cycle, either get the train into Birmingham or cycle into Stourbridge and buy a single or something. And I can, you know, it is the radio bit is indissoluble with the rest of it in that sense. And also, I know you'll like this. I don't know whether you can still come home from school for lunch, but I used to live just around the corner, and on Tuesday lunchtime, I used to sit there with a pad and paper and write the top 40 yes. down as it was being read.
Would that be like Paul Burnett or Davy Travers, that kind of
Davy Travers for some, it would have been 1980, 81, 82. No, up to 1980, sorry. It would have been kind of 78, 80.
Could have been Paul Burnett.
Could have been Paul Burnett. Kid Jensen might have done it sometimes as well. I lived closest to the school. I used to come out, you know, I mean, it was 1 o'clock and, like, school started again at 1:10. So I write it down, grab the sheet of paper, and I always remember the history in on a Tuesday afternoon first, and guess who's number three, guess who's number, you know, and that was so exciting, you know. I think there was something about being the bringer of the news as well, you know, who was number one, and how could this stay at number three, and how could that be at number one, and it's just like it was,
because although the charts became, you know, in the, I think 87 when I think Mars Pump at the Volume was the first number one when the chart was unveiled on the Sunday, rather than it'd be the last time you'd hear the chart after about three or four other opportunities in the week. But I think we were touched about the Jam. We once was, that, was the, so that sort of era. And for me, I remember bringing the news to friends at school. So this would have been 85 when it was Dead or Alive.
Yeah.
Because I think we all liked that. And I felt really sort of transgressive. It was like, you never guess that's number one. Like, really? Like, you know, well, our parents wouldn't listen to that.
It was particularly the Jam when, you know, they went in at number three with Eton Rifles. That was very exciting. Then they went in at number one with Start. And then they had four successive number ones where they went in at number one, which I think was something of a, they either equaled or. Yeah. Yeah. Did the record at that point.
They did. And also, I remember, I bought A Town Called Mellows.
Yeah.
And it was a double A-side with Precious.
Yes.
And because they flipped it. Because it was a bit naughty, really. And it also probably gave it another week at number one.
And they brought out a 12-inch that kind of kept it up there as well.
No, that's amazing. But also, you see, for me, the radio thing, and what I did, and it's interesting in those days, because people, maybe it was because I was 11 or 12, and there were much older children at the school, far cooler than me, who would bring their transistor radios to school, and they would always listen to their Ghetto Blaster, whatever it was, and they'd listen to the chart, that 12:45, it was Gary Davis by this point, and they would listen, and of course I was obsessed with this, but because I was not part of their gang, you know, then what I would do is hover and pretend, you know, and I remember when someone said, he's listening to us, you know, like, who's this outsider figure, and I was denying, no, I'm just standing here, and of course I was listening to every single word. And then I was going out and broadcasting that to all my friends.
Ineffably exciting. Not knowing, you know, who's coming down, and who's going up, and how much it was like the centre of the week, because the rest of, you know, it was then fixed for a week. But I also used to do my own charts. You know, I used to buy a lot of singles. So you know, I kept a, used to have a, it started as a top 10, as I got more singles it was a top 20 based on how I played them at home. So, and you know, I developed a system whereby you know, I had a big box full of singles, and the new one started at the back, and in the first week it was allowed to come forward 7 places for every play, and for the first week. And then after that, it, you know, everything competed with itself, so which allowed new stuff to get into the top 10.
And did your top 10 ever coincide with the official top 10?
I've had number ones that have coincided.
Can you think of any examples?
Certainly when I started doing an album chart, and this is kind of, you know, goes right outside the punk thing that I was into. Yeah. The Buggles album. I was absolutely obsessed with that for some reason. That was number one. But Gary Numan, Our Friends Electric Cars was number one at the time. The Jam were always...
The very 1979 kind of period.
I think I probably did it from 78 to 81, 82. And I lost the books that I wrote it in a move. I really wish I could see, it was a book of, a lot of memories in that book. And when you see how things come forward and back, and, it was as exciting to write out my charts every week as it was to listen to the charts.
Yeah. And the two, and also even with buying records, it was the concretization of that.
Yeah.
Experience.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, you'd hear it on the radio, but for me the reason why radio was so special is because if it was John Peel or Mike Reed or whoever was on the radio, if they were playing something, you knew that potentially maybe the friends at school, because you didn't have obviously social media then, so radio was the connection. And that's what we'd be talking about in the playground. Did you hear so and so play that last night? Yes, I did. Wasn't it amazing?
Because it was a validation.
Yes,
it was a validation of your taste.
Yeah.
You know, if John Peel played something that, that I owned, that was, you know, that was, you know, if John Peel likes it as well, then, you know, that's absolutely amazing. So, yeah, because, you know, I had my validation from the music press, and it was always sounds for me, but the music press gradually started going into the more political sphere, and you kind of, It became, there was a question of they only liked things that were cool, or they were being ironic about liking, or something like that. Whereas I think perhaps the radio, possibly because it was publicly funded, in case of the BBC, probably you felt that validation was somehow more genuine and less. It was somehow objective rather than the music press felt. It's always more subjective, whereas the radio felt more objective, even though there was obviously a lot going on in the background to decide what the playlists were and what have you.
And I do wonder the extent to which the playlist did have a bearing on what would be number one, because there were some things that on national radio they didn't play. And I'm going forward to 99 when, because Cliff Richard's Millennium Prayer, which was noticeably not really played, and of course it stayed at number one for like 5 weeks. It didn't quite make it to the Millennium number one, but or Christmas number one, but it did. It was number one for the whole of like most of December. But I find that really intriguing, because the extent to which those radio plays may or may not have contributed to a record success. Because, you know, we'd often hear that a particular DJ had pioneered a particular artist, whether they ever were, you know, take the credit for a number one, I'm not so sure. But you'd have some very interesting anomalies in that period, like watching some of the cool DJs like Peter Powell from the time announcing that Lena Martell was number one with One Day at a Time, and of course you could see that they were trying to, you know, and you knew that they were kind of like being ironic, but they were going over the top about it. But it, and that made you think, you know, they're ambivalent about it, and that was always the funny bit. And I think John Peel, who did Top of the Pops in the 80s, when he clearly, and he would do it in that very sort of deadpan way, he just knew he hated it, and a friend of mine was telling me this about when George Michael, Aretha Franklin was number one with I Knew You Were Waiting For Me. He said something like, Aretha Franklin, she can make any old rubbish sound brilliant, as has just been proven. So that was the best bit. I mean, so did you feel, if you were like watching John Peel doing something more chart-based, it was funny to think that he did do that, considering his music was so obviously not chart-based. Did that give him more kudos, or was it just a strange anomaly?
That's an interesting question, actually. I've never really thought about it, but as soon as you were saying it, I kind of thought, I think that I used to sit there thinking, oh yeah, John Peel knows. Yeah. He knows that, you know, he knows that this is rubbish. Yeah. But he knows that, you know, but he'll still do it because, you know, he'll appreciate the thing that I like as well, doing it. And Top of the Pops was actually it did have quite a side element to it as well that promoted interesting new bands, and I know a number of bands have got into become popular because they were asked on at the last minute because somebody dropped out or whatever. without which, you know, you may never have heard of them. So I think, you know, Top of the Pops also played did have its role. I mean, you know, I was also a massive fan of Gary Numan, and it was clear that initial very robot-like, icy performance of Our Friends Electric that he did on Top of the Pops, which I can still, I know, I watched it in my friend's lounge, and I can remember watching it and being mesmerised by it even now, and it was 1979. He was expecting Cars to be the hit from the next album, and all of a sudden he was at number one for 4 weeks with Our Friends Electric. And you know that, you know, without that appearance on Top of the Pops, in which he was able to, you know, get his difference and his personality over, I think he possibly wouldn't have broken through.
And I like what you were saying about the objectivity of the charts, in the sense that, you know, that because whatever factors they were in determining or shaping what may or may not, I know there's the famous story of the Sex Pistols, you know, that maybe may have been the number one in the week of the Jubilee, but of course they couldn't possibly let that be number one for obvious reasons. Yeah. So it got the number two position. I forgot what it was, Rod Stewart, I think. Yeah. Yeah. But when John Lennon died, of course, Woman and Imagine were number one, and of course you had the Roxy Music version of Jealous Guy. But of course, sandwiched between those three was Winifred School Choir. Now, to this day, because I'm a big sort of the whole Ed Stewart Junior Choice program, but I find that unbelievably fascinating that you know John Lennon, big cultural icon, but this Christmas number one was the opposite. It just goes to show that the charts could never go the way anybody would have anticipated.
Ed Stewart's Junior Choice was a massive thing for me when I was kind of 6, 7, 8, I think. Going back to John Lennon died, I remember where I was listening to you on the radio, because I used to, as I said, did a paper round, and I remember I used to wake up with, you know, everyone had one of those clock radios in those days. I woke up, always timed it for the news, and you know that was the first thing, you know, I heard when I woke up that morning. And I think it was Dave Lee Travis was possibly on the radio that morning. I can't remember exactly. But I just remember it might have been Mike Reed. I can't remember.
Could have been. I think Mike Reed took over in 81. Okay. So it could well have been DLT. Yeah.
So I remember vividly, you know, that morning listening on the radio that John Lennon had been shot, and I guess that ties in together that sense of objectivity, because all of a sudden you're not only getting, you know, the tunes of the day, but you're getting the kind of the news of the day on that day, and there's a definite dissolving of the borders that morning.
And also Andy Peebles, who sometimes used to sit in on the breakfast show if DLT was away, and I actually know that not so much from the time, because I was a bit too young then, but people of course did record, and sometimes they appear, it's wonderful. Mm. Suddenly, like, there's a chart from, I think it must be August 79, when Cliff was number one with We Don't Talk Anymore, and it's Andy Peebles who's doing the countdown on the breakfast show. But of course he interviewed John Lennon, and Gary Bunt, who's a former interviewee here, was also one of the first to hear about that, because he had to put together a documentary very rapidly because he was working as a producer at the time, including that interview with Andy Peebles to mark the death and to mark the life of John Lennon very shortly afterwards. So that blurring of the boundaries, this wasn't just a news event, it was a news event where Radio 1 was actually part of the story, because the last interview that he ever gave just a day or so before was to a Radio 1 presenter.
And you know, I think this morning I woke up to really bad news about one of my all time favourite bands, Killing Joke. Their guitarist died yesterday. You know, a band that's been I've been following since, you know, 1980, I think, so, you know, over 40 years, and so I think, you know, with the it's interesting how it kind of, I didn't expect to be going, and how death kind of marks kind of marks these moments as well. But, you know, Bowie dying was something that really affected me, and which was just a couple of days after the Lemmy died.
And not just that, and Ed Stewart that same
weekend.
So for me, I remember Jeremy Corbyn was on the Today programme, obviously not to talk about that, but they could not ask him about David Bowie.
Yeah.
And yet I was still reading, and I think also it was one of the members of the Eagles, was it? Was it Glenn Frey? Glenn Frey, who died that weekend, and Alan Rickman, I think. They were, it was all around that same period. And I was really quite overwhelmed, because I don't want to go off the point, but I wrote this book on Christmas, and there's a chapter on Junior Choice, Christmas Junior Choice with Ed Stewart. So on the day that the proofs came from the publisher, I was thinking, you know, should I tell Ed Stewart? How would I do that? What if he never replies? That would almost be worse.
Okay.
You know? Or he might reply and say, you know, what are you writing about my programme? Or maybe the lawyers would get involved and say, what are you writing about our programme? You know, he died that day.
Okay.
So for me, it was almost that I came that close. I wrote about my radio hero and never quite got that chance. But then he died, and you said David Bowie died. And it was one of those moments when everything, it was that destabilising of something, you know, the people that we grew up with. The David Bowies, the Ed Stewarts, all the sort of people who kind of mattered. And it was all happening sort of in one period around sort of 2016.
I think when people who have been so culturally important to you die, that's you know, there is does feel like something's taken away from you. And I certainly kind of feel it, because you know, both my parents are dead. I have a stepsister who died in 2020, and so I don't know anybody who knew me before I was 13, who I'm in contact with anymore. So you kind of have, you kind of like those memories. As much cultural memories as any other sort of memories, you know. And in those days, you know, I have a couple of photo albums of photos of me from, you know, from 0 to 16, whereas I probably have 10,000 photos of my kids. So there was you know, there's not as much to grab onto in that sense. So as I said, the cultural memories become much stronger. So when somebody who is a cultural icon to you, and you know, I'll admit Bowie isn't in my original list, but he became very, very important, very important to me later in my later life. You know, something gets kind of kicked away when those cultural people pass away.
Do you feel, because it's easy these days, and social media almost necessitates this, that we keep a record? I mean, it's obvious that I'm endlessly putting selfies out there, and I wonder, you know, am I doing this for my future self? Am I doing it for is it for somebody I know? Or maybe somebody I haven't yet met, or a complete stranger. You know, diaries is the same. But in your case, because it's easy now that we can just take endless pictures, and you know, you can never take, you know, never go to Boots and have them, you know, have to wait a week or so for them to come back, and you're limited by that 24 or 36, and it's too expensive.
And you never know what's going to come back, because you
lose important. Yeah. And I've done that. I lost a good Lampeter picture, but I say good. How do I know? They were good memories, but I never got to see the pictures. But do you find that with your own life, that need to go back and to try through various media, memories or newspaper stories, school books if you have them, music, to evoke that past? Do you have that need to try and go back and try to conjure that up?
I don't, actually. I think it's important that it's there. But it's for me, it's interesting. And I know one of your final questions is usually, are you a backwards or forwards-looking person? But I do look backwards, but in a sense of moving forwards. So a lot of my music, the way I look at music, is kind of backfilling. So, you know, in the early 2000s, I suddenly really got Black Sabbath. I Black Sabbath were always this old band, because, you know, when you were into punk, you kind of have a year zero, and anything before that is you know, you're rolling your eyes. And so I was kind of backfilling with bands like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin and The Doors, and kind of adding to my experience from something from the past, but in a way that was moving forward. And I'm doing the same at the moment with Miles Davis. I read Miles Davis's autobiography over the summer, which is incredibly interesting, and very honest book. And as was going in, I've become a little bit obsessed with Miles Davis at the moment. You know, I know that that won't last, and it'll become part of my mainstream culture. But at the moment, it's kind of the thing that I'm taking on, even though, you know, I have a wind-up gramophone, so I have a Miles Davis, I have a Miles Davis 78 that I can play. I have Miles Davis vinyl that I can play. I have Miles Davis CDs that I can play, and I can listen to Miles Davis on Spotify. And you know, depending on my mood, is, you know, sometimes I put the CD on of something I have. You know, I could easily listen to on Spotify, but somehow it's a different experience. But I think for me, it's about taking things from the past and adding them to my current experience and moving forwards.
Yeah.
So you know, it's. For me, it's not. Maybe it is looking at something that other people think are cool and exploring it, but then kind of making it my own.
I do think, though. No, I think that's really insightful, because for me, well, obviously, when I started even the work, even this podcast or the project on the Stelter that I'm working on, I suppose I was thinking, yes, of course we're talking about the past, but I don't think we are, because it's often something in the present that is kick-started. I suppose nationally it happened with the death of the Queen, for example, but like David Bowie's death or Ed Stewart's death, there was something which, of course, is necessitating a sense of, you know, I have an association with this, and it's an existential one. It's not just a random, oh, I remember that guy. You know, it's actually, you know, it's built into you. You grew up with that. You can't take that out of your system. And I wonder in that sense, that I think what you said is very interesting, because it's not about going back and like living the past again. I mean, the thought of going back to school and reliving those days, I mean, or even Lampeter, which was an amazing time. But I think, you know, at least one good thing about a diary is that although it makes me see how wonderful those days were, it also makes me see how there were things, not least the pressure of getting a good degree and, you know, whatever, you know, accommodation or whatever, you know, there are always going to be issues, always going to be problems, relationships, whatever, which are going to sort of impact on you. So in a sense, you want to draw on that and build on that in terms of where you are now. But I think they're saying that the two work together, because there's an element, I think, of having grown up with something that matters, but seeing why it matters, and if it matters so much, wanting almost to share that, knowing that you have to do it strategically and carefully. Because if I say to my children, I love this particular song, they're just going to say, Daddy, I hate it. In that case, I think, oh my gosh, you know, suddenly my children don't, you know, I'm estranged to my children because we don't like the same things. It's not that, but it's more that and social media can help that. You can find your groups, you mentioned your blog, you know, there's a ready-made audience who will find that sort of commonality. But I think that we're all on this journey together. And I think that it's the way that along the way we sort of tap in, different people join at different times. And it's a shared collective memory, a collective journey.
Mm. Yeah, I think one of the things that I looked at when I was doing a PhD was, I always want to say Rick Parfitt, because but who was in Status Quo. Derek Parfitt, the philosopher, wrote Reasons and Persons. And he talks about quasi-memory. And how you can have memories, but were they actually the experience of somebody else? But they kind of become your memories. And I think, you know, I have quite a few friends who are very into the music. I've quite a few friends who are called music lifers, who are kind of like have been in it from the start, and I've kind of wavered in and out over the years. But you know they have very strong and amazing attachments to some very niche record that came out in 1972 or whatever, and they kind of share their experience about listening to this. And then I listened to it, you know, in 2023, and as well as my own experience of that, I'm also somehow taking in, you know, what they've posted about and what their experience of that music is. So I don't know whether that's exactly what Parfitt was getting at, but it's certainly my reading of that idea that in terms of forming our own identity, we do actually take other people's experiences and kind of make them our own. So in this sense, when you're saying we're all in it together, in that sense, I think we are all in it together, because we're not on this kind of cultural island, this island of our own identity. We're open to, a lot of my PhD was about how the self was becoming dissolved, and how we're becoming, we're becoming much more open to other people's identities. And I was writing that before social media, and social media's turbocharged that. That sense,
and the way that these things are shaped, because it, back to what we're saying about like the playground, when you're sharing your knowledge or your fascination of the charts with your school friends, then there are always going to be contested ideas there, because you'll say, "I can't believe the Jam are number one." Somebody might say, "God, I hate the Jam," or whatever. You might think, "Oh, that friend is not my best friend today, because how dare they diss my favorite record?"
I would have rolled my eyes at making your mind up.
Absolutely, but also, and I might have done if I was born in a different era. But for me, that was the thing that clicked. It was just that moment. It was that Adamant with the I know it wasn't the Tippex, but it might as well have been on the video and Shakin' Stevens. And my other claim to fame there is that my piano teacher, I hated playing the piano, but the reason I almost went was because his parents apparently lived in the house next door. Yeah, there's lots of jokes about the green door and all that. It was an old house, but that was fascinating, because it was almost as though there are all those sort of different things, and some of it was cool, some of it was not cool, but it almost didn't matter, because everything that we did was always, we always knew that we were careful who we would navigate our friendship. You'd say the right thing to the right person, because that some conversational error is no go. Or you didn't want to have that falling out over the song so you'd carefully, strategically do. So it's actually not just, oh, this is a memory of something in the past, I like that record. It's a whole wealth of social and familial relationships, and who you identify with, the connections that you build, and whether they last in time. Often because of the way that somebody is accepting or not of something that you listened to on the radio in 1979.
I remember when I was at school in Hagling near Stourbridge, Stansted, Birmingham, and there was me and another couple of people who were really into the punk scene. And I think that quite unusually for that age group, there was a lot who had kind of were still into prog and Yes and Pink Floyd, Rush and bands like that, who did very complicated and complex in my mind pompous and preposterous things. And I remember the old Grey Whistle Test used to be it was like a prog person's dream. And I remember one night the Damned were on, and it was this was just at the cusp when punk was coming, was taking over as a major cultural force, and they were chaotic. They played "I Just Can't Be Happy Today," which has like a plink 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 sort of keyboard, and I remember going in the next day, and all the prog kids were about absolutely outraged by how this band could just like play something, that anybody could play, and Rick Wakeman used to be there with about 27 keyboards playing all this, and there was somebody just doing this, and how could it was just rubbish, it was just terrible, and me and my friends were, we circled the wagons, and we were, what do you know with this old pompous rubbish and everything. But that was kind of your identity, and that was how you were developing yourself in school, and that's really kind of the way you take yourself forward. And I also know that meeting some of these people 10 years later, they were going, "Do you know what? You were right. It was different. It wasn't." You get to a certain age where things aren't, "Oh, that's rubbish." That you have a much more nuanced idea about it.
And it might be because there's nothing to prove.
Yeah.
Because back in 1981, as you said, you might have rolled your eyes if I'd said I like Bucks first.
Yes.
But now, after all these decades, maybe you still roll your eyes, but no. But actually, it obviously doesn't matter because there's nothing to prove in that. Like, I mean, nothing you could say would change anything in the sense that that's my biography.
Yeah.
And I might agree, you know, and I'd have no problem, and I would share, and I know that it's not your sort of music. But actually, it doesn't matter because there's an integrity to what I like and you to yours. But that's the wonderful thing. You know, it's almost like the you know, for me, because I was only 7 going on 8, it was quite early, really, to have that sort of chart interest. But if it had just been a year or two later, it might have been, I don't know, Duran Duran or, I don't know, Simple Minds or something that might have done it for me. But it wasn't. And in a way, it's like I locked onto a sort of journey at a certain point, and then that was the wave that I rode and perhaps still ride today. That's my sort of way. And so if I was on Desert Island Discs, there's no doubt there would be a lot of that kind of music that was in there. But it almost doesn't matter because I can't disentangle that anymore from my own biography.
Yeah, and at that point in 1980 or wherever it was, I couldn't have contemplated listening to Pink Floyd or Black Sabbath. And now, you know, with the great experience, hindsight and everything, I now see that some of that music is incredible. Black Sabbath, particularly. If you listen to their first album and think these are a few young lads from Birmingham just setting out, the absolute mind blowing difference of what they were doing is just incredible. I think it's hard to appreciate with the benefit of hindsight just how kind of new and exciting some music was. I think it's the same with the Beatles. You know, it's very hard to understand quite how groundbreaking the Beatles were at the time, because they've become so much part of the cultural fabric of our society. But certainly, you know, back in the early 60s, the Beatles were a cultural phenomenon, throughout the 60s.
And I've got to ask you, as we start to wrap up, and I will ask you that question in the minute that you already know I'm going to ask. Maybe you've already answered it, but I will ask it again. But also, you know, as you look back on your life, is there a sense that, we've been doing a lot of nostalgia here just by what we're talking about, but do you kind of feel that the good memories tend to outweigh the negative ones? Are the negative ones able to be recontextualized by the way that maybe we frame the past through a nostalgic lens?
I think I've always been able to take the good memories and process them, the bad memories and process them, to extent that they don't necessarily affect me as much as the good memories. I think I've always been able to do that. I think my mother died when I was quite young, at 24. And that obviously had a big impact on me. But I think I was able to move forward from it quite well.
And that was also the age you went to university.
It was also I actually, my mother died in the July, and I went to university in September. So yeah, that was a big change. But I think it was perhaps, although it was already set before she became ill, it was something that I probably needed to move forwards, and I think I've always been able to kind of use somehow put things behind me and move forward. And this is certainly, not the sort of person who has regrets or any bitterness towards the past.
And that question actually leads on to what I wanted to ask about the way our younger selves may be surprised by what we do, or the way that maybe our older selves look back on the younger selves and think, you shouldn't have taken that path. I mean, you could have presumably stayed in a bank forever, you could still be there now, but you chose not to. So the younger version of yourself that worked on the till in a bank, what sort of conversation would you have with that person now?
It's a very interesting question. I think I'd tell myself to plan for the unexpected, and to actually to do what I did actually, and to let go of things and take steps. I was talking to a colleague that we both know about going out of academia, and that was one of the things we were talking about, you have things that are a huge part of your life, but at some point that those things become kind of, you don't realise that they're becoming untenable for you to, and so you have to, you know, it's kind of quite a Buddhist concept of letting go, but it's something that I've always been able to do. So I think I would be telling my younger self, well, you know, let go of things that you don't need to hold on to, and try to have the wisdom to know which ones are the ones to let go.
So it sounds like a Zen banker. and you really talked about tankers and Lobo, and yeah. You were talking about bankers. Yeah. So there's that, yeah. And you know what question is going to come next.
Yeah.
Would you consider yourself to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm definitely a looking forward kind of person. Yeah. I don't have a problem with drawing on things from the past, as we've talked about. But you know, I don't look back and think what might have been. You know, I construct my own narrative from as well as I can remember to here, and that's my narrative, that's my path. And you know, there've been turnings in the way, there've been bits that are uphill and been bits that are downhill, and there've been bits that where you kind of reached a plateau and that nothing happens for a long time. But overall, I'm very happy with the kind of road that's travelled, and I look forward to the road that is yet to come.
Well, that is a perfect way, clearly, to, you know, stop there. That's a brilliant way to end. Simon, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.